Men on the Moon.
Are you ready? Well, here we go. Men on the Moon. We're the hot men. Men on the mission. Bang, bang, boom. Here we go. Do it like this. You got to all know. Oscar, Mabel, and Mo. Don't get in the house. We're ready. So, men on the mission over here. Do it like this. Our mission. You better have fear. Do it like this. We got your ignition. Who's in the house? It's men on the mission.
Well,
hello, my name is Bob Bamber, and welcome to the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. We're jumping back in the time machine to February of 1994, where I'm being joined by my co-host Craig Wilson. Craig, good evening.
Good evening, Bob. You all right?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am absolutely fantastic. Doesn't seem so long since we last did this. February's flown in.
It certainly has, and we're going to start with the news, and the big story from February is Hulk Hogan is seemingly WCW bound after a series of rumours this month culminating in his name being dropped multiple times during the WCW Super Brawl pay-per-view. Hogan's name was even mentioned directly to world champion Ric Flair in an on-screen interview, and it is believed that while nothing has been signed officially, Hogan will face Flair at the Great American Bash in the summer.
Okay, sticking with Super Brawl, WCW held that show this month, and that was headlined by WCW champion Ric Flair taking on Vader in the Thunder Cage. Arguably the best two matches of the night saw tag champs Nasty Boys defend against Max Payne and Cactus Jack, and in another Thunder Cage match, Rick Rude, Steve Austin and Paul Orndorff teamed up to lock up with Sting, Dustin Rhodes and Brian Pillman in a fantastic match, well deserving of more than 50. Of the 50 minutes it was allocated. We'll have a full review later in the show, but it's fair to say that with clean finishes aplenty, it's like a return to WCW from 1992.
It was a 1 hour time limit draw for the ECW Heavyweight Championship at their latest set of tapings with Terry Funk, Shane Douglas and Sabu. The match, in which only Douglas completed the full hour, included interference from a number of other talents. People there in the arena itself rated the match between 3.5 and 5 stars.
WCW President Bill Shaw and Eric Bischoff have been quoted on to the extent of their ambitions for the promotion. Shaw is noted as saying, "We have the resources and the commitment from Ted Turner to make this the number one wrestling company in the business. There is no doubt in my mind that we will overtake Titan," a reference to WWF there. And Eric Bischoff followed that up by saying that there's already a belief amongst wrestling fans that WCW is the better product, when he said, "The biggest challenge we have ahead of us is making people realise we do have the better product. I think the consensus is we are better, but not enough people know about that. Only time will tell if this is any more than just warm words and bluster, but based on clean finishes and some impressive names and in-ring work, then the future is certainly bright over in WCW."
Plans for WrestleMania now, along with the two WWF title matches and Bret Hart facing his brother Owen, we will see Randy Savage face Crush, Razor Ramon face Shawn Michaels in a ladder match for the Intercontinental title, Ludwig Borger against Earthquake, and Doink and Dink versus Bam Bam Bigelow and Luna. There's a couple more matches that will probably be added to that. Both WWF title matches will have special guest referees, but neither man has been named yet.
Is Dusty Rhodes still in charge of WCW? Contrary to what we've previously reported, it does seem that Dusty may still actually be in charge of booking. It would be an elaborate and largely pointless plot, it would seem, that the WCW has worked its own roster. The lack of what has become known as Dusty finishes perhaps indicates the former American Dream was gone, with Flair announced as being the main booker. More to follow on this one, but WCW talent is said to be more upset with recent events, particularly with the poor lines of communication previously, which now appear to have been a work on the superstars.
WWF may have given away the finish to the main event of WrestleMania. In a segment taped on February the 22nd with TV that will air after WrestleMania, Lex Luger was filmed with the WWF Championship belt. While the cameras were off, Lex Luger came out and grabbed Yokozuna's belt from Jim Cornette, who had been taunting him in an in-ring interview with Vince McMahon. McMahon then invited Luger to come out to the ring, quote-unquote, as WWF champion, to show Cornette and Yokozuna what was to come. At that moment, Luger's music hit and the cameras started to roll.
The Jerry Lawler case has been settled. February saw the rape and sodomy charges against Jerry the King Lawler dropped. The charges prevented him from appearing on November Survivor Series pay-per-view with his place as team captain of the Kings, the Knights even, taken by Shawn Michaels. Lawler pleaded guilty to a lesser charge of harassing a witness and will be on probation for 2 years and can have no contact with a 14-year-old girl or break any laws during the period, or he will spend a stint in jail. The charges were later dropped after the girl admitted she fabricated some of the story.
That will conclude the news for this month. We're going to start with WCW Super Brawl. I will start with the results. Harlem Heat defeated Thunder and Lightning. Jungle Jim Steel defeated The Equalizer. Terry Taylor defeated Diamond Dallas Page. Johnny B. Badd defeated Jimmy Garvin, who was substituted for Michael Hayes. Lord Steven Regal defeated Arn Anderson to retain the WCW World Television Championship. Cactus Jack and Max Payne defeated WCW Tag Team Champions The Nasty Boys by disqualification. Sting, Brian Pillman and Dustin Rhodes defeated Steve Austin, Rick Rude and Paul Orndorff in the first Thunder Cage match. And Ric Flair defeated Vader for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship in the second Thunder Cage match, in a match that included the Boss as special guest referee. Craig, your overall thoughts on this show?
Like I said in the news there, it wasn't a bad show. I'm very pleased with the fact that we're now in a position to not have to criticise cheap and dusty finishes, if you will. There was some good stuff here. Like I mentioned in the news, I enjoyed the tag team title match. My fondness for tag team wrestling is well documented, so it's probably even less of a surprise that I really enjoyed the six-man tag as well. And with a good main event, I would probably give us a good 6.5 out of 10. It did get off to a pretty slow start, though, I thought.
Yeah, we'll come to each match individually. I think you're right, though. The first hour was almost irrelevant, with the occasional exception, but even then, I think that's being very generous. Then it was the really long, in theory, it ended just before the 30-minute time limit, the Arnold-Steven Regal match. Actually went about 27 minutes, but that was a long match, and I think that your enjoyment of the show depends on if you like that match or not, because I think if you didn't, at that point, we're about an hour and 40 minutes into the show and you've probably been bored by everything on the card. The tag match was a train wreck, both good and bad, which we'll come to. Thunder Cage match, six-man tag was excellent. And I thought the main event, it was good, but they just never really gave it a chance. It lasted about 13 minutes, and most of that involved the Boss being handcuffed to the Thunder Cage. I thought it was a good show on the whole, because the stuff towards the end was very good, but I think, as we're going to come to, Craig, it took so long to get going. I mean, the only match was meant to be Johnny B. Badd against Michael Hayes, but Michael Hayes came out in a wheelchair, citing, I think, a rib injury, being pushed by Jimmy Garvin. Long story short, Commissioner Nick Bockwinkel comes out and verifies what would appear to be doctor's note from Michael PSAs and says, right, well, you can't wrestle, but Jimmy Garvin, you're going to wrestle in his place. Go, we'll find you some gear and we'll come back out later in the show. So the opener, as it was Harlem Heat against Thunder and Lightning. Craig, as I noted during my live coverage of this, I kind of imagine that you would like this match because it was two quote-unquote proper tag teams, dressed the same, looking the same. This was probably underwhelming, I think, as a match itself. Would you agree?
It did scream a bit like a TV filler match, so not probably worthy of a tag match. Your points in regards to the small things about them at least having matching costumes, and although Thunder and Lightning, it's not the best tag team name, be it an amalgamation of the two names, but at least it sort of works as a tag team name. Both teams look pretty green here, though, and I couldn't help but thinking that after 10 minutes, nothing seemed to have happened.
No, I'd agree, and then there was the odd finish, which was the boot to the ear, which I thought was, well, unique, and not necessarily in a good way either, where it was sold very much as he'd kicked him in the ear, so much that the guy couldn't kick out. But yeah, just, It was what it was. I can't quite work out why. I'll mention this now because there's no better place to put it. Too Cold Scorpio and Marcus Alexander Bagwell were on the pre-show match, or the dark match, whatever you want to call it. And apparently that was the third best match of the night from people who were there. And you're thinking, well, why aren't these guys on on the opening match of the card, those are the guys that have got equity with the audience. Some, at least. And yeah, it wasn't horrible. The next match was, which we're going to come to, but it was fine. Craig, let's move on to the Equalizer versus Jungle Jim Steel match. This wasn't good at all.
No, it may have only lasted 6 minutes, but there is a strong case to argue that that was 6 minutes too long.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I mean, Equalizer's offense is terrible. It looks so fake, and I think it says a lot that I've seen a few Equalizer matches in the last few months that involved the Shockmaster that haven't looked half as bad. Now, okay, I think they were kind of 2 or 3 minute matches, where this was kind of 6 or 7. If Jungle Jim Steel is a bad Ultimate Warrior, then I don't know what the point is, because he's horrendous at it. If that's trying to be an imitation, it's very bad. Dave Meltzer gave this match -2.5 stars. I'd say a fraction critical, but not by a lot. We'll move on to Diamond Dallas Page versus Terry Taylor. Craig, your thoughts?
Poor Taylor. He's still trying to get over that Red Rooster nonsense in the WWF. And while he's good at bumping and making DDP look good, Page is still looking pretty green here and doesn't really offer much in the way of offence. Match drags a bit. Taylor does look good, but it's still 0 for 3 for me so far on this show.
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, I think the one upside was that DDP threw a fantastic punch about 3/4 of the way into this match. It made such a nice sound. I mean, it really should have ended the match. I mean, I know DDP wasn't going to win. But it was such a nice punch. It would have been a redeeming feature if they could have, like, accidentally built him and had this, like, brilliant right hook. But nonetheless, Jimmy Garvin versus Johnny B. Badd, the match that should have opened the show, or the Johnny B. Badd should have anyway. Craig, this match wasn't very good, but I do think this match benefited from the opening segment in the sense that the crowd were completely flat for the first 3 matches. They weren't exactly into this, but I felt that I think things did benefit from the fact they set up earlier on the show.
The crowd at very least cared about this one, which is probably the first match of the night, but considering the area that they're in, and it's a member of the Fabulous Freebirds, that shouldn't be terribly surprising. It was okay, but there was a little bit too many rest holds for me on this one, and it's another negative for me, so it's still 0, and it's now up to 4, so 0 from 4 for me so far on this show.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of thought that there was a nice finish in terms of there was an uppercut from Johnny B. Badd, and then he jumped on the top rope and hit a lovely sunset flip kind of floating over. And also I thought this match benefited very much from Michael Hayes being sat on the entrance ramp in a wheelchair just yapping away. I thought that improved the match. I think if you did that more often, that would improve. If Michael Hayes was sat offering just random thoughts during the first hour of the show, it would have improved it a considerable amount.
I don't disagree. No, absolutely. Someone should maybe give you the book for WCW.
Maybe we will see. Let's move on to what I think is kind of perhaps the turning point of the match, the turning point of the show, rather, in terms of, I think that if you didn't like this match, overall you probably wouldn't like the show. Arn Anderson against Lord Steven Regal went 27 minutes. In theory, at least, it was a 30-minute, almost time limit draw with a Regal run right at the death. Craig, this was long. I thought in parts it was very slow, but as a match, I think I probably should have hated a lot more than I did, because it was two guys, Anderson and Regal, who were just kind of slugging it out, and I quite enjoyed it.
Yeah, I mean, you were always going to get some pretty good in-ring stuff here, and you were always going to get some pretty good psychology from Regal and Arn Anderson. That was a cert. I'm not convinced, though, it deserved the half hour or almost allocation it got, considering the six-man tag later on in the show and the main event. I don't think combined came into half an hour. But you're right, no, it was okay. I'm not entirely convinced it's the sort of style that even though, like, one half of the match was made up of American superstars, I don't think it didn't have that sort of feel of a US style wrestling match, but it still looked pretty good in places. But I did just think it went on a little bit too long at 30 minutes.
I could agree to an extent, and I thought Regal, I thought the finish was quite nice with Sir William kind of leant over the top rope with his umbrella. Regal grabbed onto it for leverage and then sat on top of Arn Anderson and got the leverage pin. But that was quite nice. We'll move on to the tag title match. Max Payne and Cactus Jack against the Nasty Boys. In both good and bad, Craig, I thought this was a train wreck.
Yes, yeah, no, it was pretty crazy. It was messy. There was bumps. There was crazy stuff. There was stupid stuff. There wasn't many drop toe holds, etc., but you'd probably expect that from the four men, but it was fun. I think that's probably the, if you were watching it live, you'd get swept away in it, but if you were rewatching the match, you'd probably dismiss it for what it was, but it was always going to be something that would get the crowd going, and they did.
It might have been fun to watch. I don't think it was a fun match to be in. I mean, we'll come to a few of the things in turn, but I'm pretty sure that only Sags walked away from this match in one piece. But we'll come to that. First of all, I thought it was interesting. We had Michael Buffer doing the announcing. Max Payne wearing black trimmed with skulls, which probably isn't something he's had to announce very often. The Nasty Boys wearing quote unquote black with splash, which describes their kind of multicolour upper body garb. And then, as I say, there was a great line, I think, before the match even kind of started, when Tony Schiavone was talking about the match with Bobby Heenan on commentary, and he kind of said, which way do you think this one going? And Heenan just said, how can you predict it? None of the four men in the ring know how to wrestle. Which, well, largely correct. The match then started with Max Payne doing a German suplex, which was odd. But this match, as I say, it was high intensity. There were three incredibly dangerous spots, which I think we'll come to in turn. I thought the match itself on the whole was really intense and by far the best thing on the card so far. But then we've got that there was set up about 5 or 6 minutes into the match where a Cactus Jack on the apron, Knobs on the outside exposed some of the concrete, and then Sags ran at Jack, and then Jack took a flat back bump to the concrete. Sickening thud. And when you think that Cactus Jack was legitimately and storyline hospitalised by being powerbombed onto the exposed concrete about 10 months ago by Vader, this was a sickening spot. And then I thought, even more bizarre, that he got up.
Yeah, that was the sort of moment that he sort of had to rewind and be like, seriously, has he just done that? It looked absolutely horrific. Just bumping for the sake of bumping, but I guess if you were there and he's willing to put his body through that for that, then the crowd are going to go home happy.
Then we've got Max Payne. This is kind of what, in theory, I think would have led to the finish anyway, but involved the match actually cutting short as a result. Max Payne goes to give Knobs a Northern Light suplex, which is basically a kind of a belly-to-belly suplex with a bridge for the guy doing the move into a pin. So basically, you've got to kind of take a guy who's, you're standing belly to belly and flip him over so he ends up on his back. So the guy has to rotate through about 270 degrees. I would say, if we're being generous, Knobs probably got about 100 degrees before he landed on his arm. And this was more a kind of Northern Light suplex turned DDT as Knobs' arm was kind of crushed under Payne's back. I think he was a little bit lucky to get away with a separated shoulder, because it looked far worse real time.
It was. It just looked like such a really poorly executed, botched move. And you're right that the way that Knobs just escaped with the minimal separated shoulder that he did, quite incredible.
No, and then the finish, which seemed to be rushed, because at this point Knobs was just out of action. I think he got put in a submission move, but I think Payne did it on his good arm. And then Sags grabs the guitar, which those two riffed out to the start of their match with, and just smashed it over the head of Max Payne. Disintegrated very nicely, though apparently it did. Payne was another guy who didn't leave this match in one piece either, as the guitar got smashed over his back. And I should also add that Missy Hyatt, who has been fired by WCW for going over the head of Eric Bischoff about her contract status, but because Missy Hyatt has already been filmed for the next few months of TV, they couldn't say she'd been fired on TV. And so Bobby Heenan quite brilliantly explained that she was having a gum operation after being kissed by Cactus Jack. Craig, your kind of overall thoughts on the close of this match and it on the whole, was it kind of exciting to kind of bridge just the amount of crazy stuff that went on, or was it just stupid?
It verged very much close to the sort of independent show that you see that guys make up for their lack of in-ring talent by doing crazy spots, which is probably an accusation you could level at these four guys anyway. I did think that Max Payne came out of this looking pretty awesome, considering the fact that he couldn't hit the Northern Lights suplex even. So yeah, no, I thought the match was fun. It was a throwaway match. Neither team would be befitting of the tag team titles in any serious promotion, but yeah, no, it was a bit crazy. It was a bit fun. There was some ridiculous spots, but no, it was a pretty good match. Not the sort of classic tag team match that you'd maybe see in the NWA in the 80s, but no, it was good. Some good stuff in there.
Let's move on to the first of the Thunder Cage match, which saw Sting, Brian Pillman and Dustin Rhodes defeat Steve Austin, Rick Rude and Paul Orndorff. Craig, this was very good.
No, this was a very, very good match indeed. I think one of the first things we have to mention here is, what about Sting's pop right at the start?
I mean, a crowd that had been flat for almost everything went berserk.
No, absolutely insane. It's just like, whoa, this is clearly the fans think Sting is such a massive deal here. I just thought this was really, really, really good. Six guys, probably maybe four or five of them, right in the top of their game here. I'm being slightly critical perhaps to Rude and Orndorff, who are hardly on their way out. But if you take Austin, Sting, Rhodes and Pillman, those are four guys right at the onset of their peak. This is a great match. Sad that it only got just shy of 15 minutes that it got, but it was loaded with action and the crowd were hot throughout, which is hardly a surprise. You'd imagine if it had been given maybe 15 minutes more, this would be a sort of early contender for match of the year already, but this was brilliant.
I would agree. I mean, it's almost more perplexing that you'd have that 30-minute match earlier in the show, given that this match and the main event both felt like they'd been cut short, even though I don't think it was a case that they ran out of time. I think they planned it to be a 30-minute match in the middle and then two short matches in the main. But this was six guys who are all kind of very known to the fans. I think when you look at the stuff in the first hour, one of the main weaknesses really was that the fans didn't know any of the guys were. And that was the main issue. And when you look at towards the end, I mean, pretty much everyone on the card from the second half onwards was over to a degree. And okay, Sting dragged this up. Austin was excellent in this match. And then you've got all the other guys who are all pros. They're all very good at what they do. The crowd are all very used to knowing what they should do. And this was excellent. I mean, I think you're right in the sense that it probably was maybe not 15 minutes short of a match of the year candidate, but certainly 5, maybe 10. I think if they'd gone a little bit longer, that maybe would have punctuated it, but there was some lovely spots. They used the cage very nicely. They built to Rude hitting the Rude Awakening on Sting after the match, which I think will set them up at Spring Stampede in April. So there's certainly some options as well they can go there. But yeah, I completely agree. Excellent match. Best match of the night. And a really good show, and I think for Austin in particular, but as well as Pillman, I think two guys that it looks like those two and Dustin Rhodes are kind of three in the up and comers that WCW might look to feature a bit more as the year goes on.
And rightly so.
And moving on to the main event, Ric Flair defeating Vader with Harley Race as, with the Boss as the special guest referee for the WCW World Heavyweight Championship inside the Super Cage. Craig, this match went 11 minutes, and I think Wade Keller described it as an angle loosely veiled as a match, because it really never got going, and it's not to say it was bad. I thought what they decided to do, they did very well. But given the excellent match that these two had on pay-per-view at Starrcade, they never gave them even the remotest opportunity to have any kind of impact. They had a couple of minutes of pretty high paced action in the ring, and then we spilled to the outside with Hardy Rose just giving it all that on outside of the Thunder Cage. Boss comes over and says, right, I'm going to handcuff you to the to the cage. Vader comes out, knocks over the boss and manages to handcuff him to the cage. Race grabs the key, goes inside the Thunder cage and proceeds to beat on Flair 2-on-1. Then Arn Anderson, Ricky Steamboat come out and try and, was it Arn Anderson? It was definitely Steamboat. It was Anderson as well, that's right.
Yep.
Yeah, they come out and try and get into the ring. They can't for a while. Then Boss breaks free and the camera completely missed that. Boss attacks Vader. Flair puts Vader in the figure four. Boss then calls for the belt. I'm not sure if Vader tapped. I don't think he did. Although it certainly wasn't abundantly clear on the show.
It'd be remarkable booking if they were to make Vader quit.
That's very true. Again, this was good for what it was. I'm just not sure for what it was necessarily that well done.
No, it just seemed a bit messy. Overbooked's probably the best term to describe the match. We've seen them have great matches one-on-one, and then you just sort of add the boss into the mix as if that's going to take it up to the next level at all. Strange one, but...
Yeah, Craig, your overall thoughts on the card and a score rating?
Yeah, I thought there was a couple of decent matches, certainly towards the end. A good final run, but the first maybe four or five matches just made you want to switch off more than anything. But as I touched on in the news review, there's more clean finishes now, which is going to stop us grumbling quite so much. But more simplistic booking leads to an enjoyable show. Who'd have thought it? 6 out of 10?
Again, we seem to have different opinions on the matches and yet come up with exactly the same score. First hour was flat. I enjoyed Anderson Regal more than you did. The tag match was a train wreck, but not all bad. And the two matches for what they designed to be were both excellent. And I think it's, again, I said this quite a lot when it comes to WCW, the top end of their roster is, one, very talented, and two, pretty over. What they just need to sort out is that first hour, because consistently we're saying the first hour is involved in flat matches that aren't particularly interesting, with guys that aren't particularly over. And maybe that's the real after effect of having so many, in theory, booking changes at the top of the card, in terms of who's putting together the shows, at the top of the card stays the same. You're not going to take Vader out the main event, you're not going to take Flair out the main event. But the bottom of the card, you've got the guys who you're more friendly with, who haven't kind of politicked themselves into a corner or anything like that, and those are the guys that get spots there in the show. And I do wonder, like, someone raised the point in the Torch as to whether should pay-per-views be 3 hours long if this is the setup? Because, okay, you can't have the same four or five guys on the show, but it's like, there's nothing in the opening hour that is remotely good. And if we were just to look at the final four matches, okay, having Anderson and Regal have a 30-minute opener would be a bit weird. If it was just the final four matches, that's a really good two-hour wrestling show.
No, you're absolutely right. I mean, with Clash lasting 2 hours, if you were to just put those matches on Clash, we would be sitting here thinking, wow, February 94's Clash of the Champions was smashing, yet instead we're looking at a pay-per-view where we thought the first half was flat and dragged the show so far down that even a stellar ending couldn't bring it up much beyond past marks.
It had been confirmed, Craig, that Ricky Steamboat will face Ric Flair at the next pay-per-view. It was said that Steamboat would face the winner of Flair and Vader. You'd think they'd go with Flair and Vader again, given what happened here, but I would assume it will see Vader against the boss at the next pay-per-view as well. Your thoughts on those two matchups?
Yeah, they've sort of been hinting at Vader versus the boss on some of the WCW TV as well. I mean, they're both pretty good big men. I mean, Vader obviously a country mile better than the boss, but they're both pretty good for their sizes, etc. But still, just to go from Vader being in the main event picture to then taking on the boss, it seems a bit of a drop to me. I think the sort of way that match ended, a good heel manager like Harley Race should clearly be able to get into a contract stipulation that gets his man a rematch. But if that's how WCW want to go with Flair versus Steamboat, it worked in the 80s.
Craig, let's move on to Hulk Hogan rumours to WCW. As I mentioned in the news, Mean Gene Okerlund was interviewing Ric Flair about his match with Vader and then said, just name dropped Hogan and said, what do you think of the prospect of Hogan coming to WCW? You don't name drop Hulk Hogan if you're not going to deliver. I would say. So you would think that's going to happen.
Yep, based on Shaw and Bischoff's remarks, it's clear that they've been given a bit of a free rein, potentially with a bit of dosh behind them to aggressively go at the WWF. And I guess it really would make sense that the biggest superstar in wrestling history is the guy that they go after. I mean, we looked through his stuff last year. It wasn't great, but I mean, this guy's still got name appeal, if nothing else. And it would add a great deal of legitimacy to WC looking to take on the WWF head to head.
No, I completely agree. I mean, I canvassed Twitter earlier for some opinion. Goes by the name of Wrestling Fan, says it would change the landscape of professional wrestling as we know it. And Paul Remington said he's excited by it. Hopefully we'll finally see the program between him and Ric Flair. And I would love to see him feud with Vader. I think that's telling in the sense that Hogan comes in and opens up all these possibilities. Assuming he does come in, of course, it's not signed or official or anything like that. I've got reservations. I mean, I agree in the sense that Hogan is undoubtedly a massive draw, but it's hard to think that he's not on the down curve. And the one thing that could really affect him is that if people start going, this is Hulkamania light, this is Hulkamania on the downswing, could Hogan almost kind of go down with WCW? Is that possible?
Potentially. I like the analogy that Hulk Hogan's like a, for a football club, like a big, a signing that sort of sells shirts, but doesn't necessarily do that much on the pitch. In terms of what maybe WCW should be doing, when you consider the strength of their roster and the younger guys, to then be hiring an over-the-hill former WWF guy seems like a little bit of a contrast, and almost like you say Hulkamania light, you could almost argue WWF light. And do you beat a promotion by being a poor imitation of them? It's difficult to argue that you do.
Could the WCW fans reject Hogan? I mean, I'm speculating here, but yeah, their audiences are both very different. You know, WWF is a northeastern promotion. WCW is much more southern. Is it possible that Hogan comes in and they just say, you're not our guy?
Well, you saw how the NWA fans took to Hogan during the 80s and all the various territories, how they stuck to their wrestling guys over their superhero-esque WWF guys. So it depends on how much times have changed on that front, but I don't know. It's going to be a big draw in terms of media coverage, and you could argue that maybe that's exactly what WCW are needing. Draw some more eyes onto their product and then take it from there.
Financially, if Hogan comes in and demands the lot, is it just a case of, and we're going to come on to these comments in a second, is it just a case of what Shaw and Bischoff are saying in terms of if Turner's willing to back us, Hogan is right, whatever the price? Because, you know, Dave Meltzer was speculating that, well, maybe Hogan comes in and wants 50% cut of the pay-per-view buy rates. It's like, well, if Hogan comes in and makes the buy rates bigger, it might sell more shows, but you might end up financially far worse off. Is it worth the risk if you've got someone who's willing to absorb it?
You're right. Your point's absolutely right. I guess it's just how much more of a boost a Hogan makes. I mean, we can't dismiss the fact that it's going to create a buzz. It's going to get people at least talking about WCW. And if they think that people talking about them leads to people buying their shows to the extent that they can take that hit, then that's exactly what they're going to do. But it's also worth noting, I mean, I don't think Ted Turner's short of dosh, so I mean, he might just be bankrolling it as sort of speculate to accumulate sort of thing, and if it gets people talking about his wrestling promotion, that may be the thing that he's looking for.
I know. we'll lead into the comments by WCW President Bill Shaw and Eric Bischoff. I'll read them verbatim, although I know we cover them in part in the news. Bill Shaw, speaking to the Miami Herald on February the 6th, says, "We have the resources and the commitment from Ted Turner to make this the number one wrestling company in the business. There is no doubt in my mind that we will overtake Titan, WWF. Eric Bischoff on how the company would get there. The biggest challenge we have ahead of us is making people realise what we do is a better product. I think the consensus is that we are better, but not enough people know about that." Craig, is the consensus that they're better?
Clearly amongst their own pool, the people that they're polling. I don't think so. I think it's got better, and I think it's probably within reach, certainly within grasp, but we're not talking touching distance. But I mean, we've just sabotaged the first hour of the recent output, so it's difficult to then argue that you're getting 5-star matches on every card. So I think there's a little bit of hyperbole in what Eric Bischoff says, but with the right investment, bringing in the right talent, then who knows what can happen, especially if it creates a little bit of a buzz about the promotion.
Yeah, I mean, I guess part of what I'm going to say is based on fact, and part of it what I'm going to say is based on subjective opinion, and so you might reject the latter. But I guess the former says that in terms of numbers, in terms of people turning up at buildings, in terms of people watching the television, in terms of people buying the shows, WWF is tangibly further ahead than WCW in almost every metric. Mm-hmm. But I would say that when you watch the shows and you look at the reaction to the big names, WWF, now there's no Hogan, is a mile away from WCW in terms of having the bigger, well, I say the bigger draws, because if they're the bigger draws, they draw more kind of buys and viewers, etc., and all evidence says they're not. But in terms of the guys that are getting the crowd reactions and the guys that are more over to the people in the arena, I can't speak for people at home, I would argue that WCW is a good few paces ahead of the WWF. So while you might say that they're not within touching distance, I kind of feel like they might be if they can just sort out a few things about their undercard. The main event players are there. I don't think there's much doubt about that, particularly if Hogan comes in.
Yeah, no, exactly. There is certainly a lot going on there. I mean, we discussed the pop that Sting got when he came out. It's difficult to really think of many guys in the WWF roster that get such a reaction from the WWF fan base. So, no, you're absolutely right on that front. So, I don't know. I was going to say, certainly, and we've certainly touched upon this, the younger talent coming through. I mean, bar your sort of Scott Hall, Shawn Michaels, there isn't any sort of, you know, one-to-watch type candidates in the WWF roster that really, really stand out to the same extent as your Pellmans, Austins, etc. on WCW do. So they're coming at it from a pretty strong base. So it's what they do in the next transfer window, if you will, that'll determine whether or not they really make that breakthrough.
Something like that. I mean, I wonder, like, I think I said this on the December show, like, if you take the top end of the WCW roster and the bottom end of the WWF roster, you've got an excellent card. And I think if you take the converse of that, the top end of WWF and the undercard of WCW, you're going to be flagging somewhat. So I don't think, I'd rather be in WCW's position, because it's much more difficult to get guys to the top than it is to kind of pad out an undercard with good wrestling, even though they're not doing it. They, in theory, shouldn't be too difficult. But no, I guess we'll see. I mean, Hogan could be a game changer. I just look at, one, you look at the fact that Hogan against Flair on WWF house shows didn't draw, which is probably the reason why they didn't do it at WrestleMania. And Hogan's star, I think, is on the wane. It's hard to look at it any other way and think otherwise. Hogan was on the down curve when he dropped out of WWF. I mean, Hogan was still drawing. He'd still be there. I think that's, Hogan's still drawing to that degree. And so you just wonder whether he comes in, people realise Hulkamania is kind of dead, as they said when Hogan left the WWF. Coming into a sudden-based audience, I have my reservations, let's say that. But equally, Hogan Flair should be able to draw big on pay-per-view, and Hogan, being in the company, should be able to have a whole host of great matches with any number of names. The number of Hogan versus, you know, Sting, Rick Rude, you know, Vader, guys like that, it potentially is very exciting. Craig, we're not going to do TV reviews as a block. We're going to do them turn by turn. So let's go to you for your WCW TV review for the month of February.
Yeah, no problem at all. Bear with me just 1 second. Yep, so on the episode of Saturday Night Broadcast on the 26th of February, the Nasty Boys attacked the Equalizer after the trio had won a six-man against three jobbers. This resulted in the Equalizer saying that he was going to bring in his big brother to even the score. On the 12th of February edition, Vader broke the nose of Sonny Rogers. Steamboat attempted to make the save, but was beat down by both Vader and his manager, Harley Race, until the former Big Boss Man, now under the guise of The Boss, made the save. On the same show, a young superstar called Terror Rising made his debut with a victory over Keith Cole. Also this month, The Patriot made his debut with a victory over Todd Zane. That was recorded in January for Main Event and was finally broadcast at the end of February. And the final Saturday night episode of February saw Steamboat get a DQ win over Vader after Race again interfered. Again, The Boss made the save. And as we've hit on, it's interesting to see that the promotion clearly see some sort of something in a feud between Ray Taylor and Leon White.
Yeah, we'll see about that. A couple of comments on that. First of all, I like the fact that WCW, in competing with the WWF, has decided to go one lower on the worst gimmick name I've ever heard, following Thurman Sparky Plug with Terror Rising, which is bad. And also, I think one thing that they kind of showcased very nicely in the pay-per-view build-up was the doubt as to whether Flair was going to be fit to make Super Brawl. I do wonder though whether it might have affected the pay-per-view in terms of buy rates and interest, in terms of because of the storyline they built, they couldn't advertise the main event until a couple of weeks before showtime. And apparently that might have had a knock-on effect on ticket sales as well. They had to heavily paper the event. I think it was a 9,000 gate with 2,500 sold, and 6,500 were freebies. So, there's that as well. Let's move on to the WWF. Craig, they're, a theory at least, they've given away the finish to WrestleMania. I mean, I don't know whether this is a hoax, though I can't imagine it is. It would appear Lex Luger's going to win the WWF title next month.
It certainly looks that way. You never know what might happen in the end, but it's when you're booking so far in advance and you've got all that bank of library, you can do things like that. But as you hinted at when you were giving away the news at the start, the cameras weren't rolling for all of it, and I'm sure they might cleverly edit that in at a later date if that ends up not being the result.
Yeah, no, I guess, they forecast something, but they're certainly not set in stone. I think that's probably the best way to put it, in the sense that if they do have a change of heart between now and then, you just put something else in that segment. All right. Yeah, I mean, we had an episode of Raw that aired earlier today, which involved a title match that was shot in January. So, you know, it can happen. But let's talk about WrestleMania. We ran through the card earlier on, Craig, and we discussed this at a fairly big length during last month's show, but the card's kind of been padded out. We know certainly the major matches now. I think there's probably going to be a couple more matches added to the card between now and then. Is it fair to say probably the strength of this card likely rests on the two WWF title matches? If they disappoint, the show's going to disappoint, but if they overperform, it should be a good show?
I think so. There is, I quite like the idea of the Michaels match. But beyond that, for an event that's marking such a round anniversary as it is, the lineup does look a little bit flat. You'd have thought the WWF would have put a little bit more into it than that.
But what is it missing? Because I think it's flat because there's just not that many over guys. Because I think they've done pretty much everything they can with the guys they've got. We've got Savage and Crush. We've got Michaels and Razor. We've got Brett versus Owen. And then we've got the two title matches. There's nobody missing. Well, Undertaker's the one exception, but I think he's injured or having time off. So I don't think Undertaker's the one name that we haven't mentioned, but I'm almost certain he's just missing in action. And so I think they've done the best they could, but I don't think you can signpost any more that we're hedging our bets by having two WWF title matches. I think that's the biggest indicator that they know they're a bit flimsy at the moment.
I think you're right. I think the WrestleMania 10 card lacks exactly what the WWF lacks at this point, and that's star power.
No, completely agree. And no, it should. I'm looking forward to the card. I mean, the ladder match is interesting because I was doing some digging earlier today that I believe there were four ladder matches in prior to this. Three of them were in Calgary, although only one did include Bret Hart. There was also a ladder match a couple of years ago on Wrestling Challenge, of all things, between Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels. But the ladder match, I'm intrigued by the concept, but I've no idea if it's going to work. Because it certainly hasn't been showcased on this kind of scale before. And guys can't be that used to it. I mean, it might be good, I don't know, but it's one of those things that if it works, it props up the show. If it doesn't, it's, what was that?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I think it's a total hit or miss. It's a bit of a risk putting on such a match, for the first time in front of a really big audience. So I guess it relies on how much the WWF can press both Ramon and Michaels to make that one work.
No, I will cover the WWF Raw TV review. A fairly quiet month, Raw this month. Yeah, the lull show between pay-per-views, and also there was one show that was preempted by the Westminster Dog Show. But what we did see was earlier today, Yokozuna retained his WWF title in a DQ loss to Randy Savage. Aired earlier today, that match was actually shot at the end of January. There we had Owen Hart, who's obviously building to his match with his brother Brett at WrestleMania. He came out for a squash match earlier this month wearing Brett's glasses and did the Brett shtick before going up to a young child in the crowd. He took the sunglasses off and just ripped them up in front of him. Also, Owen tried to get involved in Bret Hart's match against Bruce Pritchard on later in the month, but despite his involvement, Brett still won. Razor Ramon and the 1-2 Kree Kid defeated the Quebecers by DQ in a tag team title match that continued the build for Ramon against Michaels at WrestleMania. It was a very good match, actually, for what it was, though I think it was fairly clear that it wasn't going to end clearly. We had Diesel stood in the entranceway, kind of providing what would turn out to be a dummy distraction as Michaels ran in from the other corner of the ring to break up the pin and force a DQ. But those are the main talking points from Raw. And now we're going to move on to ECW. We had, this didn't air on TV, this match, so it should be worth saying that myself and Craig both went into this match having managed to get a tape from America, which I think in 2 weeks is a very good effort. But we managed to get a tape from America of the Shane Douglas, Sabu, Terry Funk, hour-long time limit draw, which was, for those in attendance, were calling it a match ranging between 3.5 and 5 stars. Craig, this, it's difficult because to hear the phrase between 3.5 and 5 stars, you automatically kind of put your expectations up very high. And also in the sense that ECW does not have the production levels to properly replicate the match from a fan perspective in the arena to what we would see on videotape. I thought this was very good, and I thought this achieved what I think it probably set out to achieve, which was to kind of, a bit like last month with the kind of 45-minute time limit draw, put the company on the map. But from what I can see from the videotape we got, I think to call this match a great match is overstepping the mark.
I think so. What was great about this, though, was and the run-up to this one was Shane Douglas. For those that remember Shane Douglas in the 91 WWF Rumble as the clean-cut guy to go to this obsessed challenger in ECW. It's just awesome. ECW clearly have a lot of faith in Douglas, and I think they're investing in him quite rightly so, because he does seem like he could be quite the big deal for the company, and a good guy for them to build the company around.
No, and I could be here forever kind of explaining how the match went, but we started, but Douglas was the only guy to go the full hour. Terry Funk, quote-unquote, won the coin toss before the start of the match, so he earned the right to sit out the first 15 minutes. It was a triangle match, and I'm not sure whether it was elimination or not. Obviously, there were no eliminations, so I'm not entirely sure. But Douglas and Sabu fought the first 15 minutes. That ended rather abruptly when Sabu laid Douglas on a table outside the ring and over the barricade. Now, the barricade is much closer in ECW. It's probably only about a metre, metre and a half from the apron compared to maybe the WWF where it's 2 or 3 metres. So he laid Douglas on a table on the outside over the barricade, did a diving moonsault off the ring apron ropes from the top rope, but not on the turnbuckle, flipped over. Douglas rolled out the way at the last moment. That was a very big spot early on. So Sabu gets led out because he's selling the injury. Douglas comes out, and then those two kind of brawl around, and Sabu comes out with about 25 minutes left. Interference from everybody here. Terry Funk's Few Good Men, actually in Rotten. Paulie Dangerously got involved. Sherry got involved. A few other guys got involved. I think 911 was out there at one point as well. In many ways, it was a mess. I thought up until 50 minutes, it was a very good match. But Craig, towards the end, the final 10 minutes, okay, you're trying to play out a draw, so you're trying to build them up as all three as being kind of equal, so nobody can really get the advantage. But I just thought it led to an odd kind of last 10 minutes where nobody was really able to get the upper hand, which is kind of by design, but it never really, there was no false finishes in the final 10 minutes, and that for me stops it from being a great match, in the sense that it kind of plodded to its conclusion, I would say.
Yeah, no, I'd certainly give you that. What does make the match is the sort of just the sort of dramatic moments throughout, and the fact that it was a very sort of different style match. The triple threat match isn't a match you tend to see too often. Some of the bumps were impressive. The Douglas and Funk brawl outside the building and off camera was pretty insane. And it obviously not being broadcast. And I just think the strength, and although I'm not a huge fan of ECW and what they're doing, I'm not into that sort of hardcore type stuff, at least they're doing something a little bit different. And we talked about how WCW would be looking to challenge WWF by signing their old stars. At least ECW are trying to mark themselves out as being a little bit different.
No, I completely agree. I think this match and kind of this build remarkable more in the sense that all three guys were heels without really exception. I mean, I think the crowd really, like, Douglas was the main guy that was hated. Now, okay, I think it helped that Funk and Sabu both got the opportunity to get the kind of, oh look, I'm back pop that Douglas didn't get because he never left the match at any point. What this did lead into though, and this, the match didn't actually air on ECW TV, which is why we had to wait to get the tapes in. But what did air on ECW TV was the quote unquote press conference that aired, that was shot in theory after the match between Funk, who was very much in the press conference at least playing the babyface, saying how, you know, he'd wrestled for such a long time and that in some of the guys in ECW he thought they had some great work, and Douglas, who basically said, look, I was the only guy that lasted an hour, I deserve to be champion. Then there was a great moment where Funk says, go on, I'll give you the belt. And Douglas went, what? And he's like, I'll give you the belt so I can beat you for it properly at the show in the next month. Craig, I thought this press conference was fantastic. It was two guys who can cut a promo, just high intensity, ended in a brawl. This was superb.
And completely different. I mean, press conferences just make it seem like totally real, like in the same way that in WCW time limit draws and there being a time limit on the match makes it seem like it's a sporting contest, as does a press conference. It's simple, but it's incredibly effective.
Yeah, no, I completely agree, and this was one of my, when I say it wasn't the match wasn't a five-star match, it was very, very good. I'm not disputing that. I just think it's one of those things where if I was in the arena live and I didn't know how good it was going to be, maybe I could get swept away in the moment, but watching it from this distance, having been told how good it was, I think my expectations went really high and it came in a little bit below that, but it got the headlines. And it did exactly what it wanted to do, and it was fantastic in many different ways.
They told a great story. They did tell a great story, the three of them.
Oh, absolutely. I think I completely agree. I'd say my main criticism really was kind of the final few minutes, but the final few minutes did say we can't pick a winner between these three, and it did kind of point them going forward. I'm going to kind of motion into my ECW TV review, although that was kind of a big part of it anyway, certainly the press conference. It was also announced that Douglas was the number one contender to Terry Funk at the next set of tapings, which makes sense because Douglas was the guy who lasted the full hour. But not that Paulie Dangerously was very happy with this, Sabu's manager. He was very annoyed at Todd Gordon when he announced this. The other two, I think, bigger stories coming out of the ECW TV this month was the build of the tag division. We brought in the Bruise Brothers alongside kind of the Public Enemy and Taz and Sullivan, and they kind of had like those three wrestling other teams. But then there was, I think, the 22nd edition, I want to say, when we had, I think it was Taz and Sullivan, who were the champions, they wrestled a match, and at the end of it, the Bruise Brothers ran out and started beating them up, and then the Public Enemy ran out, and they just had a three-way brawl. And I thought that did a really nice job of kind of setting up, these are the three big teams, much in the same way that they set up Sabu, Douglas and Funk as the three big singles guys. I thought they did a really good job of saying, these are the three big guys, let's put them in a ring together. I thought that was nice. Also, we had Tommy Dreamer being billed as the first person to kip out of the Superfly Splash as he faced Jimmy Snuka, and he very much played the babyface in awe of his hero, the guy who I watched you jump off the cage a dozen years ago and all that kind of stuff. And Snuka hit the Superfly Splash. Dreamer kicked out, which much of the amazement, and I thought Joey Styles and commentary did a really nice job selling that. Snuka hit two more and won the match, but I think they're trying to build up Dreamer as this underdog babyface who's got this kind of never say die, never quit attitude. And that will wrap up this part of the show. Craig, we're going to do our moment of the month. We didn't do it for last month, so you can jump in on January as well, if you can remember that. If you can, Royal Rumble, think around that, work backwards, and the Clash. If you can think around that, but I'll start you off with your February moment of the month, and then while I give mine, you can work out your January one as well.
Yeah, I did like the Dreamer stuff kicking out of the Superfly Splash. It did look pretty cool, but for me, my favourite moment of the month has to have been that six man tag match at Super Brawl. That was just fantastic. Absolute barnstormer stuff. Although I said it could have done another, what I said 15, you said 10, 5 to 10 minutes to get a match of the year candidate. For me, it's already up there.
It would have benefited from being longer. I think we'll say that. I'm going to have two moments of the month this month, and not the ECW title match, although it was very good. My match of the month, I'm going to award to the Max Payne Cactus Jack Nasty Boys match. Wasn't necessarily the best, and in many ways it was a train wreck, and in many ways there were faults with it, but it was really watchable. I don't know why. Maybe it's just because like Brian Knobbs has got this reputation of being a bit of an arse backstage, but it was kind of nice seeing him like getting dropped on his arm, and the Cactus Jack bump, while rather illogical, you don't see that very often. The guitar shot was brutal, and the match itself, as I say, like for those are the three kind of big talking points, and in many ways they were all negatives, but the match itself was really good. Really good. It was really high octane. And as Bobby Heenan said at the start, none of these guys can wrestle. It's like, well, no, they can't, but they can all fight. And that's just as watchable, particularly a guy like me who kind of likes that style, that kind of heavy-hitting style of wrestling. And I think my other moment of the month will go to that press conference. That was superb. And Funk and Douglas were so believable in that kind of 10-minute exchange. Brawl at the end, like Funk, I don't know whether he turned face or maybe that was just kind of a de facto thing, although I'm guessing at some point you've got to turn one of them, given that they're all heels. But that was excellent. The title match, the ECW title match was very good. There were a number of good things in wrestling this month. And I don't mean to undercut even, I'm going through everything now, don't mean to undercut the six-man tag, which I also thought was excellent. My moment of the month for January was the ECW title match between Funk and Douglas. That was a 45-minute time limit draw. Again, that was different, and maybe had the ECW title match from February been in that month, I'd have given it to that. But that I thought was better than anything the WWF put out, or even WCW put out in the Clash. Craig, have you got any recollection of what you liked from January?
I did, obviously, a big Rumble fan. I'd hoped for a little bit more from the 94 Royal Rumble, but it was largely full of talent that was never going to win it. So that did nothing for me. I thought the Hearts re-splitting back up stuff was pretty good. I did enjoy that from the from the Royal Rumble undercard. But I really liked the main event of the January's Clash of the Champions. I enjoyed the elimination Sting and Flair versus Vader and Rude. I didn't love it, but it was probably the best match for me of that month. So I'm going to go for Sting and Flair versus Vader and Rude in the tag elimination match that closed.
I think I'd agree with that. I said something different, but I agree with your sentiments on January. And again, moment of the month, I sometimes say like the worst thing of the month, and I think worst thing of the month you could certainly put in the Undertaker Yokozuna match as well. That's going to wrap up that portion of the show. We are going to have some retrospective discussion. Firstly, we play Men on a Mission's entrance theme to start this show. Should be worth noting that within the last week or two, we have had the very sad news of the death of Nelson Frazier Jr., a.k.a. Viscera, a.k.a. Big Daddy V, and a.k.a. in 20 years ago mode, Mabel. Craig, it's, again, this is one of those things where this project, I remember I was watching an episode of Raw, I think, 6 months ago, and I remember saying, we're 40 minutes into the show and half the guys on it are already dead, which was frightening given that they were by no means old guys necessarily. It's the sort of thing where I think as this project goes on, we're going to have to deal with both guys we already know to be dead and two guys that are dying. But again, it's not nice, and maybe this is the sort of thing you go after someone kind of passes away, you kind of respect them more. But I think as a guy growing up watching him in the Big Daddy V Viscera era, I don't think I ever quite appreciated his talents. I mean, I'm not saying he was amazing, but I think when I was growing up, I know you just saw him as fat guy, big guy. I don't know why he's on the roster. I don't know what he offers. I think being able to look back now, certainly his early run, and even being able to knowing more about wrestling now than I did 6 or 7 years ago, I think I can look back and go, I didn't properly evaluate and really kind of tell how good Nelson Frazier was.
You're absolutely right, and it's frightening to think that, what was he, 21 or 22 when?
Yeah, he died when he was 42, so if we subtract 20, he's 22 when we're doing at the moment.
So he was 21 when he got his break in the WWF with Men on a Mission in 93. That's absolutely frightening. I remember reading online, though I can't remember the exact pay-per-view. I'm thinking it's WrestleMania 5, and I remember reading somewhere on a wrestling forum that was the event that has the record for the most dead wrestlers on it, and you're just thinking that's absolutely frightening that such a discussion and such a record even exists. And you're right, it's one of the things we're going to pick up more and more, and it is really sort of sad, especially as we're looking at a wrestling era, particularly for me that I lived through seeing these guys that you watched on TV that have sadly passed and well ahead of their time. And I never really got the Mabel stuff a lot of the time. He was an entertaining, clearly going to be a great tag team that the fans were really going to get behind. Bright colours, fun intro, rap to the ring. You saw, they got a good reaction from the fan base. And I never really thought he was going to make much with his King of the Ring win and everything, and sadly left just afterwards. But when he came back as Viscera, I just thought he was pretty awesome, to be honest. And then the sort of the fun stuff he did in his later years was pretty good as well. Just the stuff with Lillian Gassi and everything. There was some good entertaining stuff from him. But 42 is no age at all.
Craig, let's move on to the WWE Network. We're in the UK. We shouldn't be able to get this, but thankfully there are ways and means of being able to access it. I've not had that much of an opportunity to be able to watch much content on there. I've just been so busy this week. But I did get the chance to watch Chris Benoit against Too Cold Scorpio, ironically from Super Bowl 93, off the back of Tony Schiavone mentioning it in the 94 edition. And that match, for what it's worth, would have been far better than anything in the first hour of this card by distance. But yeah, I mean, again, I think you've had a bit more chance of Rotest Network than I have, but your overall thoughts, I think for both of us, this is a massive game changer for the project.
Absolutely. I think, and that leads certainly onto my rationale for really being into the network. It's the nostalgia stuff. It's the fact it's got every WWF, WCW and ECW pay-per-view. I mean, I've already arranged the WWF pay-per-views from oldest to newest, so I can start working my way through WrestleMania 1, War to Settle a Score, all that, through all the random MSG cards, and they've started putting WCCW stuff up. There's Hardcore TV. It's fantastic. Legends Wrestling. There's plenty for a guy that loves his nostalgia trip and his trip down memory lane to really enjoy the network. And for me, that's worth the money alone.
No, completely. I think for anyone who's got this far into this show is going to be interested in the old stuff. And it's weird. I'm kind of I don't want to go any further forward than where we're at, but I think it's going to give me a great opportunity to kind of go backwards a bit and look at kind of the 92, 91 stuff, just to give me a bit more of a flavour of what was going on around then. Are there any kind of shows from... Well, I mean, I guess for guys who are just jumping on the thing, we could probably recommend any shows that we've watched in the last few months. I think there are necessarily a ton of great pay-per-views that we necessarily covered. But are there any shows kind of in this era or just before it that you think people who've got the network should jump out their way and go and watch?
I think I'm going to talk about one of my favourite ever matches, and that's from the 1991 SummerSlam when Bret Hart defeats Henning for the Intercontinental title. A very badly injured Henning at that point, who was then going to take a reasonably prolonged period out of the ring, but the two of them have a stellar contest. And if you've seen their 93 King of the Ring match, you'll think that's an exceptional match. Their 91 SummerSlam match was even better.
Yeah, and I think, again, I don't think in the kind of 7 or 8 months we've been doing this podcast, we've necessarily covered a great pay-per-view. I can certainly recommend matches, but I think entire cards, I'd probably have to say no. I think Starrcade from 93, as we covered in December, the build kind of happens mainly in the first 45 minutes. So I think I wouldn't necessarily recommend watching the entire 3 hours because a lot of the matches in the first couple aren't really that good. But the build to that match at the start was very well done. And the main event between Flair and Vader I thought was excellent. If you want to go back to Halloween Havoc in October of 93, I thought Vader against Cactus Jack, I think for the time, it's one of those things where we're doing the show kind of trying to be retrospective. And occasionally you kind of have to think, I enjoyed this match a lot, but if I hadn't seen what comes in the 4 or 5 years or 7 or 8 years after it, I'd probably appreciate this match even more. I think you watch Cactus Jack and Vader now, that match Halloween Havoc, it's a very good brawl, but given what's to come, it kind of gets a bit lost in the shuffle. I think when you watch that match and trying to appreciate what was happening at the time, I thought it was an exceptional match in terms of what they put on. That was good. I know you like the Heavenly Bodies. Was it Steiner's match, SummerSlam 93? Is that right?
Yes, that's...
I know you like that match as well. But again, and also, as I've been saying a couple of times on Twitter, if you want my dare, 3 hours, watch Battle Bowl. Be bored out of your skull. Craig, you haven't seen Battle Bowl, have you?
I've seen enough of it.
Right. Fair enough. Fair enough. I'll leave it.
I think the fairest thing that we can say is, from our time doing this podcast, as much fun as we have had blethering about the events of that time, the best we could probably put out in terms of a DVD or a tape, if we're keeping kayfabe, would be a mixtape. Match from here, match from there. I don't think we'd include more than 2, maximum 3 from any one show.
No, I completely agree. I think in terms of the score rating, I think I might have scored Starrcade an 8, although that was almost exclusively on the strength of the main event. Other than that, I don't think we've had a pay-per-view that we've ever consistently scored above a 5 or a 6. And Super Bowl wasn't bad. In terms of the shows we've watched since August, Super Bowl was pretty good. I think if you want to turn on Super Bowl and watch the final 2 hours, I think you're good. Your final 90 minutes, you might not like Regal against Anderson. But certainly the final 3 matches on the card are very watchable. But I think you're right. We're looking at snippets and segments, nothing major. We do, however, look forward to next month. We are out of retrospect now, so I can talk about it a little bit more. WrestleMania 10 is next month. I think it's March the 20th in real time. I'm going to be live tweeting that show on the Saturday, I think. Let me check my calendar. March the 22nd is a Saturday. I'm going to be building to that for the next few weeks. People have got the network. If you've not got the network, I am going to provide a stream so that people can jump onto that as well. If you've got the network, Saturday, March 22nd, I'm thinking of starting at about 9 o'clock UK time, which is 4 o'clock Eastern on the Saturday. I would go later, but I'd probably fall asleep during the main event. We are going to be live tweeting WrestleMania 10. Craig, I very much hope you can be there. I'm going to try and get Colin on both for that and for the show that we do the following week as well. But that's certainly going to be a big deal. And I think that's probably, I mean, we spoke about earlier in the show, and again, I'm trying to manufacture opinions, but we know kind of how good the Bret Owen and the ladder match is from that show, certainly. So I think that's very much going to be a very enjoyable thing. And I just think for the project as a whole, you know, it's, I can torrent and download stuff to watch, and I can provide it for people who want to watch it. But I think to be able to go to people, we're going to live tweet it tonight. You can go on the network, or even like follow along with our tweets on another day and just watch the show. This is for this project. The network is a massive game changer, I think.
Absolutely, and I would like to point out that WrestleMania 10 easily makes my top five, if not top three, favorite WrestleManias.
Excellent. It's also worth saying that I believe that Spring Stampede coming up in April is also regarded as a very good pay-per-view as well. So as much as I say we haven't had a great pay-per-view yet, I think in the next couple of months, we might have a couple of very good ones. But by all accounts, there's an incredible tag match in that, which lasts about 7 minutes, which is bloody unbelievable. And then there's Ric Flair, Ricky Steamboat, which apparently is excellent as well. So we've got all that to look forward to. Anyway, Craig, that's going to wrap up this week's show. Plug your Sun Scotland column, your blog, and anything else. Let's do that now.
Yeah, no problem at all. Probably the easiest way to keep tabs on my musings is to find me on Twitter. You'll find me at CraigW4584. There I post out all my links, and as Bob said about my column, writing about wrestling up here, up north in Jockland, where I cover all the best stuff, including going to see Premier British Wrestling tomorrow evening. Looking forward to that. And I also write and edit a blog called Ring the Damn Bell, and you can find that at ringthedamnbell.wordpress.com.
What was your thoughts on the two impacts that you saw in person? I think we discussed this off air last time. But how did Impact compare seeing it in person to the TV product, if you had a chance to see it?
It was good, but I thought watching two shows back to back, it is a bit of a slog, if I'm being honest. I would say at least a third, if not slightly more, of the crowd filed out before the second one was halfway through, which was a pity, because that was the one that had the, what's he called? Abyss versus Eric Young Monsters Ball match, which was probably the best match of the two shows. The second show probably did feature the best in ring action, and it's a shame that that was filmed in front of a reasonably flat crowd. But no, it was alright. It was, if someone that's used to more seeing sort of the WWF phoned in house shows that frequent Glasgow, I was pleasantly surprised by the fact that there was a little bit more meaning in what was going on. It was a good night, and I did enjoy.
Well, if it's someone who's used to WWF house shows, there might be a bit of a culture shock given that they've not watched the program for about 14 years. But yes, if they're into WWE house shows, then very much so.
Through the podcast by talking about Twitter, so don't start.
Well, that's true. That's true. Yeah, all right, I guess. Well, we've actually done pretty well. We used to make it mix up all the time, but I don't think I've done it for a while. I've got NXT Arrival to what we're having a chat now. So like, yeah, at Wrestling 20 Years Ago on Twitter. I'll wrap it up in a minute. But no, I've got NXT Arrival to watch in the next couple of days. I've also got Impact to watch that I was at. It's the first of the two tapings from London that I saw. And I get the impression, and you can speak to this as well, that there are so many backstage segments. It's untrue, really. That every segment has to seem to bookend with a backstage segment, which I think hurts their matches because none of them seem to run longer than a quarter hour.
And if Tron didn't, or whatever their version is, didn't work for the first show in Glasgow, so all we heard was, muffled voices backstage with nothing going on, so it was like, what is happening? I think that hurt the atmosphere a bit in Glasgow.
That's better than we got. We just got no Tron, no backstage segments at all. I don't know whether they kind of thought, well, we're running long or we're boring people or anything like that, but it just kind of, from what I saw of the live stuff, it seemed to be for every match they wanted to have a talking segment, and that felt a little unbalanced, and then we're going to have all the stuff added in afterwards in post-production as well with all the backstage segments. I wonder, but again, I mean, I enjoyed it very much, so by all accounts, the Impact episode that aired last night was quite good, so I'll go and watch that. Anyway, we finished chatting all there, that went a bit weird. But yeah, as I say, you can follow me on Twitter at Bobby Bamba, you can follow the project at Wrestling20YRS, we're on Wrestling20Years.com is our website, you can listen to all of our old episodes, we're on iTunes, on RSS, etc, etc, etc. Again, March 22nd, WrestleMania 10, live tweet, 9 o'clock UK, 4 o'clock Eastern. I'm going to be promoting the hell out of this because I want as many people as I can watching and live tweeting this show as I can get in the next 3 weeks. I think with the network, it's massively easy, providing the network works, but we'll come to that again. But anyway, until next time, I've been Bob Bamert. This has been the February 1994 edition of the Wrestling 20 Years Ago podcast. And until next time, goodbye.